Although, O sons of God, you have promised more firmly than ever to keep the peace among yourselves and to preserve the rights of the church, there remains still an important work for you to do. For your brethren who live in the East are in urgent need of your help, and you must hasten to give them the aid which has often been promised to them. For, as most of you have heard, the Turks and Arabs have attacked them and have conquered the territory of Romania as far west as the shore of the Mediterranean. They've occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in 7 battles. They have killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. On this account, the Lord, beseech you, as Christ's heralds, to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It's meant also to those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it. All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea, whether in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. This I grant them through the power of God with which I am invested. Oh, what a disgrace if such a despised and base race, which worships demons, should conquer a people which has the faith of omnipotent God and is made glorious with the name of Christ. With what reproaches will the Lord overwhelm us if you do not aid those who, with us, profess the Christian religion? Well, that was arguably the most famous public address made in the Middle Ages. It was on November the 27th, the year 1095. The guy who delivered it, Pope Urban II. You probably guessed it, that launched was to be the first of many crusades. And the Christian church has been reeling from its stain ever since. Our topic tonight is religious evil. I'm a Christian of the Bible-believing evangelical variety, but it might surprise you that I'm not here to defend even my own brand of religion. Because there's no denying it, all right? Evil has been done. Evil has been done in the name of my religion. It's just a simple fact of history. And if you're religious of any persuasion, even if it's not Christian, the other fact of history is that evil has been done by your brand of religion too. All the major religions have been guilty of atrocious things. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, even Buddhism. I mean, certainly Jews have suffered much, but they've also committed some inexcusable acts in Palestine. We know that the 21st century since 9/11 has been, I guess, so far, it's Islam that's been the biggest threat, hasn't it? Buddhists, that religion of peace, well, not if you live in Myanmar and Sri Lanka. There have been some atrocious evil done by Buddhists in those countries. And Hinduism in India is responsible for a caste system, a graded humanity that has meant that ethnic groups, particularly one ethnic group, is discriminated against, repressed, and untouchable. You see, no matter what your religion or religious inkling, you've got to take this matter seriously, yeah? I hope you feel the weight of someone like Dawkins when he says in his book God Delusion, Richard Dawkins, famous atheist, wrote this, "Imagine with John Lennon a world with no religion. Imagine No suicide bombers. No 9/11. No crusades. No witch hunts. No gunpowder plot. No Indian partition. No Israeli-Palestine wars. No Serb-Croat-Muslim massacres. No persecution of Jews as Christ killers. No Northern Ireland troubles. No honor killings. No shiny-suited, big-haired televangelists. That'd be a good thing. Fleecing gullible people of their money. You know, God wants you to give till it hurts. Imagine no Taliban to blow up ancient statues. No public beheadings of blasphemers. No flogging of female skin for the crime of showing an inch of it. Imagine. Imagine. As I said, my job tonight isn't to make excuses for religion, not to make excuses for mine, not for yours. So what do I want to do tonight? Just two very simple things. Firstly, I would like us to explore what's common across all the major religions in terms of religious impulses. Right, what is it about the religious impulse that would cause evil, regardless of what religion you're talking about, Christian or otherwise? Let's explore that. Let's deal with it. Let's get into it. But then secondly, I'd like to actually do something, which is to propose a solution. And it's a solution which at the moment to you might seem a bit contradictory, because I think the solution might come from Jesus. Now you're just thinking, hang on, you're going to talk about religion and Jesus? Well, stick with me here. I actually think that Jesus will actually offer something beyond the religious impulse. Something beyond religion. And I hope you hear him out tonight. So let's go. Firstly, I want to share with you what I think, as I've thought about this and read about it, what are the religious impulses true of every major religion? I'm just going to, you know, just for convenience sake, tackle the big five: Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. All right? And I'm not going to really talk about the sects and the cults and the fundies and the fanaticals. I'm not going to talk about religious people who do things contradictory to their own beliefs. So priests and child abuse, horrendous as that is denounced by the religion itself. I think it's easy pickings to go for the fundies, the fanaticals, and the child abusing priests. I mean, that's just too easy. I think we need to look at religion, the five major ones, in a sense, at their purest form, and see if there are religious impulses that are common to all of them, or at least to most of them. And I want to suggest four of them, four religious impulses that I don't think they necessarily lead to violence and evil. That would be wrong to say that, right? When considered especially on their own, they don't necessarily lead to violence and evil. But I reckon they're like kindle for the fire. Do you know what I mean? They lay the groundwork for the right spark. And sometimes what will ignite it is nationalism. You know, something else will be mixed in with it. A violent act committed against them, and then suddenly the spark is ignited. I think these religious impulses lay the kindling for the spark that might result in something like 9/11 or the Crusades. So what are these four religious impulses? They might probably aren't the only ones. Let me suggest these four, though. First religious impulse, only the elite, right? Elitism. Second religious impulse, merit through sacrifice. Third religious impulse, this is what God says now. Fourth religious impulse, we can build utopia. I'll go through them one by one, so if you didn't catch it, that's fine. First one, only the elite. All right, this is the religious impulse that excludes entire segments of humanity from salvation or enlightenment altogether. Right? If you're born of that untouchable class, it's beyond you. Or it at the very least will grade them from close to far. And it's often an elitism based on factors beyond your control, right? Like what race you were born in, or what gender you were born in, or what cultural group you belong to. So higher access is given to the elite and not to the others. So I mentioned the racial caste system in Hinduism. But you know, the caste system is actually also there in Judaism, Japanese Buddhism, and Christianity, especially of the colonial variety. It's there. A gender inequality, right, in Islam, in various forms of historical Christianity, in Judaism. This is what we mean by elitism. And Mikey began with a quote from Christopher Hitchens, and I think Hitchens is getting at this. I'll just read the quote out. I didn't memorize it because I'm not as smart as he is. But he said, this is what Hitchens said, violent, irrational, here's the word, intolerant, allied to what? Racism, tribalism, bigotry, invested in ignorance and hostile to free inquiry, contemptuous of women, coercive towards children, organized religion ought to have a great deal on its conscience. All right, this is the elitism, the first religious impulse. Because once you have an us versus them, you see how it's so easy. The next step is to galvanize us against them. Elitism. Number two, second religious impulse, merit through sacrifice. Now, this is a common one. Religious people call on you to sacrifice yourself in various ways in order to earn favor with the divine, with God, or whatever your equivalent is. And the greater the sacrifices, the greater the merit. Okay, merit through sacrifice. Ramadan, right? Ramadan is a 40 days of fasting. Pilgrimages, common to many religions. You do it in order to earn sacrifices. Now, of course, the ultimate sacrifice is your life, isn't it? Man, that's the biggest thing you can give, your life. Now, you see how easily this religious impulse can lead to crazy acts of fanaticism. So Pope Urban II, in his speech to launch the Crusades, he said, basically, if you come and fight, if you die on the way, you get immediate remission of sins. Right? You jump straight across purgatory into heaven. Merit through sacrifice. Islamic Jihad uses this principle, doesn't it? To offer paradise. Right? Merit through sacrifice. The second impulse. Third impulse. This is what God says now. What I mean by this is that I think a problem that all major religions have to resolve, and mostly without success, is the question of how do we know what God or the divine is saying to us now? Right? This is a major religious impulse, or at least a major religious question. It's the question of interpretation, especially of holy texts. Every religion has a holy text, right? But how do you interpret it? How do you know what God is saying now? I mean, if you're a Christian, how do you interpret the stone adulterers passages in the Jewish scriptures or the Christian Old Testament? That's what it says. It's there. It's in Deuteronomy. What do you do with that? How do you interpret the jihad texts in the Quran? How do you interpret the texts about caste system in the Brahmin text of the Hindus? Do you see what I mean? If you can't have a consistent way of interpreting, then you see how easily you can just proof text. This is where the scary bits come on, because you take whatever passage you want from your holy text and you put a label of this is what God says or this is what Allah says, and then you use it to justify all manners of violent, oppressive, and evil. Right, this is what God says. Third religious impulse. Number four, the last one. We can build utopia. And the key is we. Right? Utopia is a common theme in most belief systems, not just religious, but even philosophical. But this is the key. We can build utopia. This religious impulse believes that a perfect world, the utopia, is possible and achievable in the here and now by human effort, blessed or perhaps commanded by the divine. We can build utopia. It's the impulse for the sort of Christendom, heaven on earth type thing in the Crusades. Definitely that was how they felt when they captured Jerusalem in the first crusade, the only really, I guess, whatever you term a successful crusade, but from their point of view, that was a successful crusade. They captured Jerusalem. They created heaven on earth, utopia. It's the impulse for Sharia law, isn't it? It's the impulse for a perfect theocratic Israeli state. We can build utopia. And you can see how this impulse can lead to wars, lead to conquest, lead to jihad, lead to crusades. Right, those four. And remember, I'm not here to make excuses for Christianity. As an organized religion, each one of those has been a part of historic Christianity. But here's the thing. I want to suggest to you that unlike the others, Christianity, or rather, let's not focus on the religion, let's focus on Jesus. Jesus offers a solution from within. Right? In a sense, I'm saying, yes, Christian religion has been guilty too, but from within lies a solution. They might not have always appropriated it well, but the solution lies within, because it's with Jesus. Because when you're confronted with Jesus of the Bible, these kinds of religious impulses, funnily enough, are given the strongest critique. In a sense, we don't have to critique them because Jesus does. And he offers the most satisfying solution. Now, Dawkins' solution, and John Lennon's, I guess, is imagine there's no religion, it's atheism. Now, I don't think that's a solution. It's not the time to really deal with that, but I really don't think that atheism is a better alternative. I don't think atheism would offer the kind of critiques needed from within. And if you want to look at history, 20th century atheist regimes have arguably caused more human suffering and death than all religions in the 20th century combined. Right? I don't want to go down that route because I don't believe that's a solution. But Jesus offers something intriguing. So I want to show you that. And if you probably would have got one on the way in, there's a little sheet, A5 sheet, with John chapter 2. And I just want to read through that. I want to show you how Jesus does this in a very surprising way. This comes from the Bible. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scriptures and the words that Jesus had spoken. It's a fascinating little episode. Early in Jesus' life, from one of his biographers, right? His disciple, his friend John, wrote this. And I want to look at this in a little bit of detail in reference to each of those four religious impulses. I want to show you how Jesus systematically demolishes each one. First one, remember, only the elite. Now, you need to understand a little bit of architecture of the Jewish temple to really get what's going on here. The Jewish temple, this was the second temple period. It was built, designed, in fact, to highlight elitism based on race, based on tribe, based on gender. So right at the center of the temple was what was called the holy place, the sanctuary, right? Within which was the Holy of Holies. And the Holy of Holies was guarded by a thick, heavy curtain. Now, who could go in that curtain? Well, only the high priest once a year could go in that curtain. That's one man of a particular tribe and of a particular special anointed status could go in once a year. Now in the sanctuary, though, others could go in, but they had to be priests, which meant that they had to be a special class of people from, again, a tribe, the tribe of Levi, right? That's right at the center. Now, the next kind of, it's not concentric circles, but it's just kind of concentric, I guess, squares or rectangles. The next court, well, only Jewish men could access. That's called the court of men. Then you've got another wall, the next one. And the next court was for Jewish women. You had to be Jewish. You had to be a woman. Or you could be a woman, but you had to be Jewish to go into that court. But then right at the outer court was the court for everyone else. All right, the goyim, the goys, the Gentiles. All right, that was where everyone else could access. So you see how it's set up? You had to be more and more and more elite to really access God, who was right in the middle. Now, this is elitism at its best. Jewish male of a certain tribe chosen out of that priesthood to gain the highest access. In fact, they found an ancient inscription, just an archaeological discovery. And it was the inscription, essentially, that they think was hung outside of, between the outer court, right, the court of the non-Jews, the Gentiles, and the next court, which is the court of women. The inscription said something to the effect of, if you're found beyond the walls of this outer court, may your blood be on your own head. Essentially, if you go in there and you're not Jewish, right, someone kills you, it's not our responsibility. Now look what Jesus did in this fascinating little episode. Look what he did. He went and he drove out those who were doing commerce. Now where were they? They were in the outer courts, the court of Gentiles, non-Jews. Now some think Jesus did it because these guys might have been dishonest, right? Dishonest people, you know, at markets. I was at Salamanca Markets this morning, and I think most people were really honest because they didn't look like me. When I go to Asia, on the other hand, oh boy, you know, you got to be really careful because I know I can insult my own race, can't I? Yeah, I can. Yeah, I mean, you know, Asian stallholders, you be careful of them because they're there to rip you off. So, you know, be really careful. Now, is Jesus doing that? Is he in there thinking, oh no, these guys are dishonest, I'm going to overturn? No, I don't think that's what's going on, because there's nothing in the text that says that that's the reason why. See, Jesus gives the reason, though. He says, you've turned my father's house into a market. The issue isn't how honest they were. The issue is what they were doing. Now, in the other biographies of Jesus, the other gospels, he actually says that this is supposed to be a house of prayer for the nations, for the Gentiles. And that's his reason. My father's house, which is supposed to be a house of prayer for the nations. In other words, so little did the religious elite care about those on the edges that they actually filled the outer court with commerce, so much so that the Gentiles, the non-Jews, and this was the only place they could come, they couldn't even get in because it was so filled with commerce. Jesus was against that. He wouldn't have a bar of that. See, well, what he was doing was symbolically giving access to those with the least access. But you see, more than that one act, if you know about Jesus, his whole life demonstrated this, didn't it? I mean, Jesus, he honored the outcasts of society, the women, even the Gentiles, the non-Jews. He honored them, related to them in a way that no respectable Jewish rabbi had ever done before or since. And there was more to come, because in his death, Jesus would actually demolish all of the walls once and for all. We'll come to that in a moment, though. I want to go to the next religious impulse that Jesus demolishes, though, which is merit through sacrifice. You need to understand a bit about the commercial arrangement of the temple. The Jews, they were commanded in the Jewish scriptures, or the Christian Old Testament, they were commanded to go on pilgrimages once a year to Jerusalem from wherever they were in Israel, and they had to go to this temple. They couldn't just set up little shrines at home. There was only one place they could worship. It was in Jerusalem, and they needed to go there to offer sacrifices, animal sacrifices for their sins. Now, if you think about it, you live on the outer edges, right? Imagine you had to all come to Hobart because it's the center of Australia, apparently. And we in Sydney, you know, without flights or even with flights, we're not going to carry our sheep and cows on Jetstar just because you have to pay so much extra. And it's budget. And, you know, and it's just not practical to carry all your produce and your, well, no, not your produce, but your sacrificial animals. So what do you do? Well, you travel on your pilgrimage to Jerusalem, right? And then there at the temple, there you could get your money changed, and there you could buy the animals that you now needed to sacrifice. Do you see how the whole sacrificial system was facilitated by the commerce, by the markets? Now here's the thing, you may not have realized this, but when Jesus disrupted the commerce that day, he actually disrupted the whole temple system of sacrifice. Do you see what he did? No merchants, no money changers equals no sacrifices. That's what it meant. But that was exactly his point. And that point was driven home when he was questioned by the religious authorities, and they said, what the heck are you doing? And he says, destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days. A very enigmatic statement, isn't it? They didn't get it. But the writer John tells us that Jesus was referring not to the physical building temple, but he was talking about his body. He was talking about his body being the temple. He was talking about when he would die and 3 days later rise again. That temple would be rebuilt in 3 days. Now, I want you to understand how monumental that is. Right? Jesus wasn't just disrupting the day's commerce. He was actually symbolically putting an end to the Jewish system of temple and sacrifice. You got that? That's what he was doing. And when he referred to his body as the temple, that was driving it home. He was saying, in effect, what you do, what you sacrifice, where you sacrifice, no longer matters at all. Doesn't matter at all. You don't need it anymore. No sacrifice. No merit through sacrifice. Why? Well, he said it. I am the temple. Why doesn't he? Well, because he was about to become the sacrifice that ends all sacrifices. Here's the clincher. When Jesus died on the cross, the Bible says very clearly that he was there not because he deserved to die, but he was there as a sacrifice, a substitute for humanity. Now, all those animals that symbolically in the Jewish system were supposed to deal with sin actually didn't deal with sin. But Jesus, the perfect man, he dealt with sin. When he hung on the cross, he bore all of our sin in our place instead of us. He was the sacrifice. He died for us. And he dealt with it once and for all. So one of his last words on the cross was, "It is finished. It's done. No more sacrifice needed." And so when he died on the cross, he opened up access to God, and it was no longer going to be based on our merits. Right? It's not sacrifice for your merit, for your favor before God. No. He sacrificed himself once for all. That's all the merit you need. You don't need your own merit, Jesus is saying. I've done it for you. You just need mine. And that's why at his death, guess what happened at the temple? Remember, right in the center of the temple? Holy of Holies? Big curtain? All the Gospels record. Curtain ripped in half. A very symbolic ripping open of access to everyone. See, the whole temple system has collapsed because Jesus was the sacrifice to end all sacrifices. But as I said also, Jesus was the temple. He says, rebuild, I will raise it up in 3 days. I am the true place, Jesus says. I'm the place where you're going to find God. I'm the place where you're going to meet God, because I am God come in the flesh. Mind you, this also is the nail in the coffin for elitism, isn't it? Because once you destroy the need for a physical temple, those walls dividing humanity, races, genders, all of that collapses as well. If you've ripped open the curtain and you're saying God is open, accessible to anyone, not just the elite, but anyone, all races, all cultures, all genders, rich or poor, which is what he did by his death. Once you've got that, you've killed elitism once and for all, haven't you? And it's all because Jesus says, I'm the temple. Now here's the thing, if Jesus is the place where you find God, then naturally you have a solution to the next religious impulse, don't you? Remember the third religious impulse? This is what God says now. Jesus is the temple. He's the place where you meet God. He's the place where you hear God. He's the place where you see God, where you have your prayers answered, where you have God's revelation clarified. This is where you have the Holy Scriptures explained. It's in Him. You see, Jesus is the interpretation of the Bible. Everything revealed by God before Him and after Him must be interpreted through Him. That's what it means for Him to be the temple, the place where you meet God. Now, that's why, if you're a consistent Bible reader, you don't stone adulterers, right? And the other things that the Old Testament or the Jewish Scriptures forbid. Why? Because Jesus, famously, what did he do? He stopped one adulterer from being stoned. Woman dragged out before him. Jesus says, he who is without sin cast the first stone. You see? Yeah. He offered her a new beginning. He is the way you know how to read everything. And I believe Christians haven't always done this well. Right? We can proof text. There are some Christians who will proof text. But with Jesus, you have a consistent solution to that problem of what is God saying now? Do you see that? What is God saying now? Well, the answer is Jesus. Well, what does Jesus say? What did he say? What did he do? How does his life and death and resurrection reinterpret everything? Now, if you want to know how Christians read the Bible, that's how you read the Bible. That's how you know what God says now. Jesus. And of course, along with that reinterpretation through Jesus is the fourth religious impulse, which is we can build utopia. Because Jesus' words at the end of this episode categorically destroys this we can build utopia business. Remember what he says? He says, destroy this temple and I will raise it up. Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. His resurrection was a supernatural act of God. Right? I know there might be people here who doubt the fact that he might have come back to life, resurrected, and again, that's a topic for another day. But I encourage you to have a look at the historical evidence. Christianity stands or falls. Jesus stands or falls on this. You can't have Jesus being a good teacher, a good rabbi, or a good moral guy if really he didn't rise from the dead, because he said he would. All right? Investigate that. But let's just for a moment assume that he did rise from the dead as a historical, real fact. Well, his resurrection was a supernatural act. If it did happen, it has to be a supernatural act. This is not cooperation between God and us. There is no we. It is just him. And resurrection is a big theme in the Bible that actually points to utopia. Resurrection is the idea of God's renewed world. What God does in a person, he will do to the whole universe. And now when Jesus says, I will raise it up, he is saying that God's utopia comes about only by God's doing, through him. No we. I will raise it up. Utopia comes about by God's doing through him. And if it's in and through Jesus, remember that's our interpretive grid anyway. If it's in and through Jesus, then how does utopia come about? Well, it's not going to be by force. It's not going to be by armies. It's not going to be by crusades or jihad. It's going to be by imitating him and speaking about him. It's going to be by sacrificial and unconditional love. It's going to be by offering grace and forgiveness. It's going to be by preaching and teaching about him, because he is God's offer of salvation, reconciliation for all people and all races and all genders. They can come to God through him. And utopia is going to happen, but it's going to happen in him. See, the renewal of all things, if you interpret it through Jesus, is going to happen, but it's going to happen on the other side of Jesus, or what the Bible calls Jesus' second coming, his return to judge. Right? He's going to bring it about. He's going to finish it. He started it. He's going to finish it. In other words, right, this world ain't it. This world ain't going to be utopia, and we ain't going to be the ones who build it. There you have it, four religious impulses. As I said, I'm not here to defend Christianity. I mean, historical Christianity, with all the good that it's done, and I think we need to be fair, Christopher Hitchens would make you think that religion has done nothing good. Not true. Christianity, like all the major religions, have done a lot of good. But it's also participated and instigated much religious evil. And the problem with historical Christianity, here's the thing, it's not because it's too into Jesus. Funnily enough, it's because it ain't enough. It ain't into Jesus enough. All right? Because rather than looking to Jesus, you see what Christianity has done throughout history. In the last 2,000 years, it's taken to the natural and universal impulses of all religions. And that's led it to commit inexcusable acts like other religions have. What it should have done is look at its founder, Jesus. So tonight, I'm going to be very, very, very clear as we finish up. I'm not calling you to excuse religion, right? And I'm definitely not going to call on you to become more religious. No way. But what I'd like you to do is look at Jesus, right? Look at Jesus, who by his life and death and resurrection actually brought an end to religion, because he destroyed the religious impulse. If you're in any doubt that this is the case, remember that it's actually a result of the actions of that day. Jesus driving out the temple, really cheesing off the religious authorities. That's one of the reasons why they had him killed. All right? Jesus himself suffered at the hands of arguably the greatest act of religious evil ever. Religion put God on a cross, because when God became a man, he tried to destroy and end religion. Right? Jesus is not on about religion. He's not on about the religious impulse. So will you, regardless of where you are in this journey of seeking or even a skeptic, will you take a second look at Jesus? Will you consider him? Will you come to meet him? So I invite you to actually go deeper into him. Right? Rather than go deeper into religion, go deeper into the person of Jesus, who is there in the pages of the New Testament, in the biographies, in the Gospels. Get to know him, read about him. You might have been, probably were brought by friends tonight. They're the best people to ask. Say, hey, you know what? It's changed my mind a little bit about Jesus. I thought one thing about him. I thought he was just all about religion. Not really. Can you tell me more about that? There's stacks of ways that your friend who brought you can help you. There's an info desk on the outside, and I invite you to take a look. All right? To be fair to this topic, I hope you come to see that Jesus offers a possible solution. I'm going to pray, and then we'll end it here. Will you join me in prayer? Dear Jesus, some people here know you, and we thank you for that. But there are friends among us tonight who don't, and even as I pray to you, there might be doubts in their mind that you really exist. So if you do, Jesus, I really pray that you would tonight begin to show yourself to them. And I pray that we would be fair to the person who you are, and at least the person you reveal God to be in the Bible, and help us as a result of tonight to begin looking at you. Amen.